On this second tape, Larry and I found ourselves in deep waters discussing fatherhood in America. I dubbed these the Watergate tapes.
God mad at me too, okay. Because God is like my father too. You don't realize that the father is supposed to be a source of a blessing, not a source of humiliation and depression. So you hope not to pass the traditions of previous generations on your own children.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, the status of fatherhood in America is in my opinion, quite pitiful. And it's, I guess, a root of a lot of problems in society.
It is.
Fathers that, you know, make excuses to continue to think and function like a 16-year-old or an 18-year-old. They never mature. They're like kids raising kids. You know, they hang up the wife and kids so they can go chase skirts or chase
after business opportunities.
Exactly, materialism, yeah. And so on. And
see, a lot of what happened is their fathers, our grandfathers,
right,
came out of the World War I experience,
yeah,
and which was a really disastrous war. A lot of our grandfathers drank and were alcoholics. We're dysfunctional. We're not able to communicate to the children. And because they were alcoholics also, weren't able to be stable in their personality. So my father would never know when his father came home if his father was going to be glad to see him or say, go to your room, get out of my sight. I wish I'd never, you'd never been born. You know, you don't. When you grow up not knowing if you're a source of pain or enjoyment to your parents, you feel like, something's wrong with me. What's wrong with me? Well, I'm gonna be perfect. I'm gonna make my dad love me. I'm gonna make so that child, our parents, in order to try to make their parents really accept them, became super achievers. That's why that generation seeks after financial security so much. Wants significance brought through their work so many hours, don't really pay attention to family. Okay, so our kids, us, grow up, the hippie generation, is really upset because their parents, you know, their mother's there for them, but, you know, she must be stupid if she thinks they have value, because obviously they don't, because their daddy won't talk to them. So mommy is not only, you know, insufferably attentive and involved with you, it's almost like the poor mother who really is there for the child gets a lot of damage. Like, I'd take something to my father and say, what do you think of this story I wrote? And he'd say, yeah, you made a couple mistakes here. You know, non-restricted clauses are set up by parenthetical commas. And then I'd go to my mother and say, what do you think of this story, you know? And I mean, I got 99% on one story, I remember. I only missed one thing, which was those parenthetical commas.
Right.
And my mother said, oh, this is a wonderful story. See, my mother was looking at what I had done. I had written a story. My father was looking at what I'd failed to do, which was to be 100%. Because he was trying so hard in his generation to be perfect so his father would accept him and love him. So our generation gets God upset that we couldn't get our father's love. So we decided that's all that's important. Love, that's all that's important. Who cares if you get a good job? Who cares if you're at the top of your field? So that's where the whole hippie thing came out of, a lot of anger. And that's why love was such a theme. You know, we were against the war. See, and also our fathers went to World War II and tried to be perfect. I mean, they really believed in that war. People were enlisting. I mean, people believed in that war. And they came home to find that maybe their wives had run off with other people, or they didn't come home. I mean, there's a lot of bitterness came out of that war. And it also made men really remote, as their fathers had been from the war experience.
Right.
So we haven't really fought in a war. I mean, Vietnam, a lot of kids went to war, but it was not as encompassing numerically as World War II.
Right.
A minority of young men fought in Vietnam. So, and before, you know, just as Vietnam was beginning to crest, the hippie thing was already generated. So that's why there was such an emphasis on love, because we were angry because we couldn't get love.
That's an interesting paradox. What are your thoughts on love being motivated by anger? It almost, you know, the whole hippie love power thing was very anticlimactic. You know, there was, I guess, sincerity in the cause, yet there was, the motivating factor was not necessarily.
No, anger is, and attacking your parents because you think they're hypocrites when you haven't had a chance to become an adult and find out if you're a hypocrite or not. You know,
yeah.
And what is a hypocrite? You know, to
and they're being hypocrites themselves by standing there and saying, you know, you need to get your cred together because you don't love like we want to love or something
yeah.
like that, and it's motivated out of anger. You know, this is a real resurgence in this fascination with the 60s lately.
Yeah.
And which is, you know, there's a lot of, I guess, some positive things that came out of the 60s. A lot of stuff came out of the 60s. But it really was this kind of an idealistic love.
Yeah, well, it wasn't really love. It was selfish. If these,
absolutely.
See, I lived in San Francisco. I lived a couple of blocks from Haight-Ashbury when I was growing up.
Yeah.
If it was really love, why were they so horrible to the sailors and the soldiers that were on leave? Why didn't they love them and support them and say, we wish you weren't in the war, you know? Why weren't they supportive to their parents? Why didn't they go home and love their parents the way they felt they should be loved from their parents? Why were they so horrible to the tourists that came in from other parts of the country to see the love generation there in Haight-Ashbury? If their purpose was to show love to the world, why didn't they love the tourists that came through? Why did they, you know, insult them and swear at them and throw things at them or charge them $5 to take their picture? You know, they loved themselves.
Yeah.
They didn't even love each other. They were ripping each other off, stealing each other's dope, stealing each other's girlfriends, having sex with people they didn't really care about, ripping people off emotionally.
Yeah.
There were murders in Haight-Ashbury. There were, you know, hippie murders. A little girl named Groovy was found in the trunk of a car. You know, that's never recounted in any of these retrospectives about the Haight-Ashbury situation. All the drug overdoses isn't recounted. All the murders, that's not, you know, only the concerts in the park with the Grateful Dead, only the Fillmore, you know.
With this great cause of acquiring unity and love.
Well, that wasn't really a cause, that was just a word they were using. It's easy
absolutely.
To say peace.
Yeah.
You know, there wasn't any peace in Haight-Ashbury.
That's the media likes to remember it in a romantic
yeah,
sense.
Right.
In the good old days when we were simple and we really wanted love. Now we want money. They wanted money then, too. That's why they're in the
that's
money
right.
now.
Well, they were
yeah.
they were getting money from their parents so they didn't have to work, so they could go into Haight-Ashbury and live in a pad with 14 other people with mattresses thrown all over the floor and take drugs and not have to have a job. I mean, they were, you know, they were ripping their parents off. They were panhandling on the street to the tourists, you know, give us some money, you know, give us $5 if you want our picture
right.
so we can go buy more drugs.
Yeah.
And it didn't last very long. I mean, the Summer of Love only lasted a few months. And then, you know, Altamont was just one step behind the Summer of Love. So it was, I mean, I was there.
Altamont being, I've heard of
the Rolling Stones concert
okay.
where the people, the Hell's Angels were hired for security
I
forces.
I saw the documentary, Helter
yeah.
Skelter. That was bizarre.
Yeah.
Absolutely bizarre. It was like a dream.
Yeah, but you could see that on the streets of Haight-Ashbury. You
yeah.
could see people that were so doped up out of their minds, they'd run down the street screaming and hitting people.
Yeah.
They didn't even know the people. They were just running randomly down the sidewalk, hitting people that they passed, hitting them in the face with the, you know, whatever they had in their hands. These people were out of control.
Mm-hmm.
Drugs is a horrible thing. Drugs doesn't help you find God.
No.
Drugs doesn't make you more enlightened. The people that think that drugs is beneficial to them at that point in time are usually, when I talk to people, they're usually still on drugs now.
I've unfortunately have a friend who is a Christian who for years I've respected, but I think just out of the same way that a child rebels against his father, he has rebelled against his heavenly father, and he's bought into this, you know, hanging with the cats and, you know, listen to, you know, some old burnout, acid rock, and let's drop some, you know, some chemicals, and, you know, because it really does expand your consciousness. And he really tried to convince me when I went over to visit him, see how he's doing, he really tried to sell that to me. He goes, I can't explain, Steve, but you sit there, you do it, and you just, it expands your consciousness, and you can sit and analyze things on a different level. It's, you know, and I'm going...
Sure, you can. You can analyze that. Gee, I am one with the chair, you know? I'm one with God. The chair is God.
Yeah.
I am the chair. I am the walrus. You know, you do analyze things on a different level, but it's not a level of reality.
No, absolutely not. And it's scary when a person feels like they have to resort to chemicals to do something that we should be able to do on our own biological basis.
Through God, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Maximizing this creation that He's given us, you know, we are incomplete until we give this carcass back to Him and the spirit that He's put in it to, so we can commune with Him. But no, we go like...
There's no statistics to show that anybody who took drugs in the 60s turned out to be a better person or a better artist for it. I mean, John Sebastian couldn't even write songs. You know, by the time he was at Woodstock, he couldn't even remember his own lyrics on stage.
Yeah.
And he's only written one notable song since then, Welcome Back, for the,
yeah.
you know, Welcome Back, Cotter. I mean, he was writing songs. His albums were so much fun. They were just coming out one after the other, and he lost the ability. It blew his mind.
And this whole drug thing, you know, I remember growing up in the 60s.
I don't think anybody believes that John Lennon wrote better songs after all the drugs he took. You know, by the time they really started taking drugs, there was a disorientation on their part. It's not because the Beatles broke up, they weren't writing good songs. It's because Lennon continued to take drugs, McCartney continued to take drugs. McCartney, you know, also, the kind of drugs you take come through in the music. If you take heroin, like Clapton was taking, and like Lennon was taking, there's a real kind of angry emotional disorientation. There's a real lot of pain. But if you're taking marijuana, you know, tie sticks like the McCartneys, your music comes out silly. You become a silly person. It affects your body differently.
Right.
I got to be so aware of it that if you told me this artist is taking drugs, guess which drugs he's taking?
Uh-huh.
You know, what's his drug of choice? Then you play me the record and I'll tell you what drug he's taking.
Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah, marijuana makes people real stupid. It really dulls their senses.
Yeah. Slows them down.
It gets into the cerebral cortex. Marijuana stays in your body. It stays in your fat cells. It stays in your synapses. People talk about LSD giving you flashbacks, you know, because of the synapse information that's traded off. Sometimes it gets released a lot longer after you take... I mean, if you stop taking drugs, as the fat starts to be discharged, like when you don't have a meal, you know, you start to burn off fat.
Right.
That's when the chemicals come out. That's when marijuana comes back out. It takes you 7 years for each cell in your body to be regenerated. So if you stop taking drugs today, 7 years from now, you'd have a chance of not having any flashbacks. All the marijuana would be out of your fat cells. I just think drugs is horrible.
Yeah.
And there's not one artist that improved because he took drugs.
And you're talking about marijuana. I'm
talking about what people say is not even a drug. It's just, they used to say it was like candy.
Oh, they lobby for marijuana.
Yeah.
You know, and Oregon loves to lobby for marijuana.
Yeah, isn't that your number one export?
Well, yeah. That's I guess, theoretically it is. I've heard that.
I'm not
really sure, but I've heard that. and it's ironic that it's illegal, but yet it's the number one export.
Yeah.
But yet they lobby for something that has that kind of biological effect on a person. You know, because they're so caught up
in... Like Dylan said, money doesn't talk, it swears.
Mm-hmm.
People do stuff, strange stuff for money. You know, money gives you power, gives you autonomy. You don't have to listen to your boss if you don't have a boss.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to listen to the car mechanic explain to you why your warranty doesn't cover what's gone wrong with your car. If you just go out and buy a new car.
Right.
You don't have to listen to anybody. You don't have to listen to the police if you've got enough money to just make your bail and get out of jail and then keep on having extensions on your court dates. And some people stay out of jail for 10 years, you know. A lot of people that are in the drug business don't expect to live for another 50 years. They just think, okay, you know, I'll probably get murdered.
Make a lot of money.
Yeah, make a lot of money, live to the, you know, ultimate height of materialism. And when I get killed by some drug dealer, wants to take over my territory, I don't care. I had the best life I could have. Why live to be 80 years old and be poor and suffer and, you know, just it really self-destructive hedonism.
We're really blending into something that I wanted to address, and that is how drugs are affecting our current culture. You know, I remember growing up in the 60s, and I remember, you know, reading about, hearing about, you know, just the insanity of what was going on with the drug culture, teenage, young adults, you know, kids overdosing, jumping off of buildings, the whole shebang. I remember it was just a big, scary future for me because I was You know, I was very young. You know, I was, you know, 10 years old or whatever, and this was looming. And it seemed like, you know, guy, is this ever going to stop? This insanity. And it kind of seemed to taper off, in a sense. It kind of tapered off, and we got kind of through the late 70s, and it seemed like it was all over. You know, well, remember the 60s when everybody was taking drugs and jumping off buildings and, you know, poisoning food.
Well, that's what the media was reporting.
Yeah, whatever the case may be. But then all of a sudden now, you know, it's resurging.
Well, drugs didn't taper off. It's just that we stopped thinking. You know, I never took drugs, but people my age stopped thinking that drugs was an answer to anything. They realized they had to get a job if they were going to make rent, and they didn't have 14 people they wanted to live with in some small apartment. And they didn't want to share rent. They wanted quietness, and they wanted to be in love with one person who loved them back, not be in love with a different girl every week.
Right.
They wanted some peace in their life, some stability. And drugs really just got stronger. I mean, people stopped using drugs recreationally for fun, and they started using drugs for escape. Started using drugs because life can be painful, especially after you've messed yourself up really bad. You know, the results of some of our sins last for years and years.
Do you feel that the reason the drugs, even after all that went on in the 60s, that they didn't taper off, but they continued to escalate because of escapism?
Well, yeah, drug dealers aren't going to say, well, I guess I go into another line of work now that people aren't taking as many drugs.
Oh, yeah, they're gonna.
They go, okay, if they're not taking marijuana from free choice, then we have to get them addicted to heroin. We have to get them on cocaine. So that's why you saw a sudden upsurge in media attention to cocaine, because cocaine became a lot more prevalent.
Mm-hmm.
Well, marijuana dried out. Who do you think makes marijuana dry out? Do you think that it stops growing? No, you just stop selling it. You just go to other drugs. You know, people aren't giving you big hefty profits by choice, and get them addicted so that they have no choice but to take drugs.
Right. They're creating their own market, the drug dealers.
Yeah.
It's pretty pitiful.
So the nature of crime has also changed. Because now a majority of crimes committed are committed on drugs,
mm-hmm.
or because of the need of drugs.
Right. Burglary. Killing because
probably 95% of the prostitutes are addicted to drugs. And have been pulled into prostitution against their will. They probably didn't, after graduating from high school, go off to the big city to become a prostitute. But they might have run away from home at some point, not finding the love at home that they needed.
Right.
And getting upset and being petulant like children are, running away from home and then befriended by some stranger in a city, find themselves addicted to a drug and then told, yeah, if you want some more, you have to work. You know, you work for me now, I own you. Don't try to run away because I'll make sure you never, you know, just the threat and the addiction is what keeps young children in prostitution. And after a while, the sense of degradation and the humiliation keeps them there. They don't want to go home. What, you know, are their parents going to accept them now? If their parents didn't love them when they were children, are their parents going to love them now that they're a burnt-out prostitute?
Right. It's a vicious cycle.
Robbery is caused mostly by the need for money.
Right.
But, you know, or quick money for drugs. If I were working in a store and somebody came in to rob the store, you know, I tell the employees that work for me, don't ever resist whoever comes in because they're probably on drugs.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they don't know what they're doing. They might kill you if you say, well, I don't know. You know, just say, yes, here.
Yes.
Yeah, there's printed instructions. If you ever go into a bathroom in some place like a 7-Eleven, you know, the public's not invited to go to use their facilities. But if you go in there, there's two or three gigantic pieces of poster on the wall that tell you exactly what to do.
Mm-hmm.
And if you wonder why people are so friendly when you walk into 7-Eleven, they go, hi, how are you? Can I help you?
Mm-hmm.
They want you to know that they're looking at you. They know what your face is like. Because usually burglars will come in and kind of wander around the store looking at stuff, picking up a few things like they're shopping. But they're just trying to get a sense of what the right moment is to steal, you know, to rob. And if you're standing in line at 7-Eleven and somebody's in front of you, they'll often get the person in front of you to turn around. They'll look at you and say, did you find everything you need, sir? Then the person in front of them goes, hey, wait a minute, I'm in line first. Who's this guy? Is he trying to cut in front of me? They turn around and look at you. Now they've got an eyewitness. So usually burglars will leave the store if, you know,
Interesting.
If they're being, yeah.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I feel real sad when I walk into 7-Eleven. I'm on the road somewhere, getting somewhere, and 2 in the morning I go into 7-Eleven to get some Evian or something, and the poor kid in there is really nervous. Hi, sir, can I help you?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I don't want to say, hey, I ain't going to rob you.
Yeah.
You know,
then he's going to go,
oh, no,
this
guy's robbing. So I just walk up and say, hi, I really need some help. I let them get a clear look at me so that they know that I'm not trying to avoid their gaze. But drugs has changed the nature of crime. Drugs has changed the incident of murder. There's a lot of people are murdered under the influence of drugs. So, Noriega wasn't chased down because he was a Latin American suppressor of minority, you know, third world nations. I mean, he's chased down because he's destroying our country. He's destroying our youth.
Yeah. Sending it up here.
Yeah.
Money, pocketing the money, and he really cares. You know, how it affects in the long run.
Yeah.
Why did you return to the States? Why did you return? We'll just leave it at that.
Because I'm an American.
Yeah.
You know, it was nice to go and relax in Europe, but I felt like I needed to get a hold of whatever was wrong with me. I didn't even know what was wrong with me. I didn't realize that I could get healed through therapy. All I knew was that things were getting more and more distant. I wanted to come home, you know. I wanted to be around my parents or my brother or my sisters. And
so you didn't necessarily feel, okay, I feel rested up and able to tackle things again.
No, it got worse. Year after year, it got worse.
Yeah. But you just sense the need to be home.
Yeah.
With your family.
Yeah.
And
I was trying, I kept writing songs. I could write songs, I just couldn't finish them in the studio. While I was over in Europe, I did 30 songs. In a two-week period, I did 2 songs a day. You know, for 15 or 16 days, I had 30 songs. But I couldn't finish them. That was the same problem I'd had. I mean, altogether, I had about 70 songs recorded. I couldn't put out an album of 10 songs. I could start a song, but to concentrate long enough to finish it took hours and hours, which added up to days. And my brain couldn't function.
You're talking about like with the retakes and everything like that.
Overdubbing.
Yeah.
Just
you could go out and go through the song live and get through a 2-hour set because you started the song and went straight live.
Right. But recording is different.
Concentration. I understand.
Yeah.
And, it's interesting how you would think that just the ability to...
Dylan can cut an album in 4 days.
Yeah.
You know, he just sings them while the guys are playing.
Uh-huh.
And that's what it sounds like a lot of times. And Slow Train Coming was a beautiful album, and that was not done in 4 days. That was carefully done. That was done and layered little by little. Mark Knopfler layered his overdubs. He did his leads after the band left. You don't want to be trying to do your best lead hoping that this time the band's going to get it right. You know, it's like building a building. The foundation goes in first. The track is cut with the rhythm guitar and the drums and the bass and the keyboards.
Right.
Then when you get the right take, like, okay, everybody did all the right notes. It built correctly, it came down sweetly, and then it segued out. So that's the take, okay. Then you start overdubbing your best attempts at guitar, and then you start overdubbing your best attempts at vocals. You know, say, I'm going to have to come back tomorrow and try to sing this again. My voice is just shot.
Yeah.
You know, so it takes days to finish a song.
A lot of concentration to get that consistent picture that you're trying to hold.
Yeah.
And if you don't have that consistent...
Well, I couldn't remember what song we were working on. I couldn't remember which album we were working on. In the meantime, while I'm trying to finish an album, I was writing more songs. And I'd get excited and say, oh, let's go record these. And so I'd go and record those. Now I had even more songs that were never going to get mixed down. So I came back to America, and I was just thinking, what is it? Am I lazy? How come I can't finish anything?
Right. So how did you discover that the therapy would help?
I got married.
Okay.
My wife noticed I had a problem. Like, I'd go to the store to get something, and I wouldn't come back for a couple hours. And when I get back, she'd say, where have you been? I go, I don't know. She said, well, remember you were going to go to the store and get some milk and stuff? And we were going to have dinner right away? Oh, we were? Oh. Did you remember to get the milk? I think so. I think it's in the car. Yeah, let me go look. Nope, it's not in the car. Oh, maybe the trunk. Oh, yeah, it's in the trunk. Okay. Okay, here's the milk. Where were you for a couple hours? I don't know. So she just thought, you know, I was indifferent to her. It really hurt her feelings. She thought I didn't care enough about her to remember to come back 10 minutes later to have dinner. You know, and it wasn't that at all. She finally realized it was just, it permeated my whole life. And she'd see me go in the studio and work really hard and never be able to finish anything. So then she started trying to figure out what it was and started talking to different doctors about it. Because she could only say what the symptoms were. She didn't know if anything was wrong. Maybe this was the way I am. She didn't know. Maybe this was my personality. And then then I talked to a couple of the doctors, and they said, there's definitely something wrong. I don't know what it is. And then one of the doctors recognized all of the symptoms and says, I have an idea what it is. And so he started treating me, and I started getting better. It took about 2 years to come up to where I am now.
So she didn't recognize it when you were, like, in a sense, engaged, or as much as that was due to it becoming progressively worse.
Well, you wouldn't have noticed, really. It's a dysfunctional characteristic. If you ask me a question, I start answering it, then I get off on a tangent and go way off and never remember what we were even talking about.
Uh-huh.
At least now I'm trying to answer the questions you're asking me instead
right.
of forgetting, what were we talking about? Was it about music, or was it about death, or was it about war, or was it about the church? What was it? I mean, my mind would wander because it couldn't. See, your logical side, when I'm answering your question, the creative side is going, how do you feel about what he's just asked you? And then I summon up these memories of how I feel about something, my emotions, plus my logical side comes up with the Bible verses. I said, yes, that's right, this is a scriptural viewpoint. Then my creative side has to figure out how to say it to you at the moment so that it's not boring, I'm not coming out saying, talking in a monotone, I don't know how I feel, I only know what I'm thinking, I'm saying. And that's something else she said. She said, whenever I ask you, how do you feel about what's happening? How do you feel about your new song? Or how do you feel about the album not being done yet? And I say, well, I think that, and after a couple of years, she said, you know, you always tell me what you think, and you never tell me what you feel. Have you noticed that? And I said, no. But I think that probably has to do with, you know, I mean, I just did it again and again and again. I didn't know what my feelings were. I wasn't in touch with my feelings. My skull had been so badly damaged.
And this was from an airplane crash.
Yeah,
right?
This is from a 747. The ceiling in the airplane came down on my head. There was nobody else in that part of the plane except me. The paramedics were there when the plane taxied up to the gate. I thought I was okay only because I wasn't dead. And because I think it's so wrong when people sue just because they slipped on your floor, you know. So I thought, well, I guess I'm okay, you know. I don't want to sue. I'm a Christian. I don't sue people. The Bible says don't sue people. It just says don't sue your brother. I mean, if I'd have known all the trouble I was going to have and all the expenses I've had just going to treatment, I definitely would have said, you know, you have to pay all my medical bills for the rest of my life if I can't get over this thing.
Right.
But I just assumed nothing was wrong because I've been in accidents before. And, you know, if you fall down, but you're okay, why pretend that you're hurt? Why pretend
right.
that, you know, you're damaged? Why put a fake thing around your neck and keep it on for a year and a half hoping to collect some amount of money in a court? I mean, I'm a Christian. I don't lie.
It wasn't noticeable at first. It just be gradually.
Well, I guess if somebody like my mother or father who really knew me well, they would have noticed it right away. But I live in Los Angeles. They live in San Jose. They did notice that something was wrong, but they just thought, he must be really tired. He acted really strange this Christmas.